And if you know any youth that are interested in getting more involved with environmental issues, our website is ayea.org. And definitely look us up, and we're always looking for more people to get involved. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, and thank you to Aya and their wonderful program. I will continue to giggle about Mrs. Alaska, and that approach to issues is often sometimes the most healing way that we can deal with some of the critical things we face in our lives and the world's lives. So certainly within the youth, there's so much inspiration and passion in their voices and spirit and actions, and I deeply appreciate that on behalf of all the pioneers. So I'm quite honored also to introduce LaDonna Renbind this evening. LaDonna's home is in a land and culture very different from our Alaskan experience. She's been organizing in the heart of inner cities, where, like many inner cities around the world, residents are unable to access basic human needs, including access to fresh and healthy foods. LaDonna is from the south side of Chicago. She learned about mobilizing communities during the campaign to elect Chicago's first African-American mayor. She has a varied and diverse career in working with neighborhood initiatives, with youth, people with disabilities, and now creating farms and farming jobs on the west side of Chicago. Her work with the Institute for Community Resource Development is focused on several programs relating to assisting residents of urban communities obtain access to safe, healthy food through the development of alternative food systems. Because as LaDonna realized through her work, there was a fundamental need to change the systems in which created the food desert that she was facing in terms of organizing. The organization's work is a combination of advocacy, policy development, and, ironically enough, direct service to the land and the people by linking vacant lots, soil restoration, engaged youth, seeds, and a whole lot of solar and human energy to create vegetables. And how cool is that? So I'd like to extend a big Alaska welcome to LaDonna. I'd also like you know that after her talk, she will be available for some questions after her presentation. And LaDonna, welcome to Anchorage and to Pioneers in Alaska.
Well, good evening. And they were totally right. I cannot see you guys. But you can see me, right? And I can't see the timer either, so. That's a sign of being old. That's what that is. Well, I'd like to start off by thanking the core group of the Pioneers Alaska for inviting me to come up. I really do appreciate the opportunity to share my story and my journey with all of you. I'd like to start off by really asking that we take an opportunity to remember the ancestors. There's an African proverb, actually it's a Yoruba proverb, from the people of Nigeria that say that if we stand strong, it's because we stand on the shoulders of those who go before us. And that's true for all of us, I believe, that I am standing on the shoulders of my father, who had gone before me, of course. And I'm standing on the shoulders of my grandmother, who has gone on before me. And I'm standing on the shoulders of my great-grandmother and all of those people who have lived their lives so that I may be able to live mine. And those that are connected to me, those that are not so connected to me by blood, but by land. And so I salute those ancestors who have gone before me, those people I like to call the names of George Washington Carver, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. those people who we sometimes cannot recognize the names of, but we know that we exist because they existed. And I am sure that you have those people in your lives, and I ask you to take a second to just call forward those ancestors who lived on this land prior to our coming to this land, and we know that without them, we could not be here today. You know, it's very interesting. Today I was listening to one of the speakers talk about a calling, and she talked about her calling, and she also combined calling and interchanged that word with journey. And I like to begin my talk by saying how my journey began. And I suppose that my journey began with a calling and the yearning to become a mother, to be a mom, and to give birth to a child was really, for me, a rite of passage. It was an introduction to not just a way of being in a new family, being a wife, but now being a mother and taking on much more the responsibility of protecting our future by surrendering to the universe the opportunity to produce through me. And that opportunity introduced me to a calling that I've really always had, and I'll explain that to you a little bit, because I think it's very important in this work to take the time to understand that these connections and these projects and things that we talk about are very personal. I know I come to this work for a very personal reason. I have to tell you that I would not be here if it had not been for my son. I do know that my son will stand strong because of the life that I have led, as well as my daughter. But his coming forward pushed me forward in a way that I had not anticipated, and it pushed me forward into a calling that I was not prepared for. I have to tell you that I wasn't interested in the environment. I didn't care about trees. It's not that I didn't acknowledge trees. I just, didn't care that much about trees. I did not understand the connection between the earth and myself. And I think that's fairly typical. I think that that's not unusual. I think that many people, many, many, many people, walk around without this, overt, understanding of their role in the environment or their partnership in the environment. So in that way, I was fairly typical. I think I was also fairly typical in thinking that my food, the food that, I pretty much ate every day, was something that just sort of appeared. That through no work or deed of my own, I could show up at a place that was chock full of stuff that I could purchase. I had no understanding of how that stuff got into that place. I had no relationship to the stuff that was in that place. I didn't really understand who spent their time making that stuff. But I did assume that that stuff would always be in that store. And when I showed up, that pretty much whatever I had on my list, I could get. And I didn't really have an understanding of what it took to get those things there so that I had the opportunity or the luxury to purchase those things. So I come to you to tell you that one of the things that is very important in my journey and in my calling, and I'm suggesting that it's also important to you in your journey and in your calling, is that the personal is very political. Without a personal connection, it's hard to become political. With my son, it was very, very troubling to me to be introduced to a medical system that couldn't exactly tell me what was wrong with my son, and that's a completely different talk, I have to tell you. But to be introduced to a food system that did not have a solution for my son's food allergies At a very early age, my son was about 6 months old, we learned that he developed food allergies. He had some very serious food sensitivities. He was allergic to shellfish, eggs, peanuts, and all dairy products. And while we were trying to figure out, well, exactly what that means, we were introduced to something called the food system. And again, I have to tell you, I'm not a person who knew that there was such a thing as a food system. I just knew that there was food, it appeared, I bought it, I took it home, I cooked it, you know. It was relatively healthy. I don't really know whether it was or it wasn't at that point. But I listened to what the advertisers said. They told me it was healthy, so I believed them. And that's how I purchased food. But with the introduction of my son and having to avoid pretty much those food products, and by the way, that was pretty much the medical advice, just avoid that. Don't eat, don't buy stuff that has that stuff in it. It's like, duh. Of course not. But what do I buy instead? Which was that's the bigger question. What do I buy instead? And they didn't have that, you know, answer. That's when I began to take on the idea that there was something I needed to do. And you know, I can't tell you that immediately I knew what that was. My something was I just wanted to feed my son. As a mother, and many of you are probably parents, and understand the deep desire to make sure that your child is taken care of after an illness is really something that you can't almost articulate. It's just, absolutely, I'm going to do that. Whatever it takes, however long it takes, whoever I need to talk to, it doesn't matter. As I began to sit down and ask some really what I thought was simple questions, I realized that I didn't know anything about food. Yet I ate it every day. It was the cornerstone of my life. It was the cornerstone of my celebrations, weddings, funerals, birthday parties, holidays. But I knew nothing about the food system. And as I really sat down and said, you know, there's something going on here. This is not quite what I'm looking for. I go into the grocery store, and I was sort of confused because I'm like, okay, I've got this list of stuff that I've got to avoid. How do I do that? And I immediately realized that anything I bought in the center of the store was pretty much out the door. That's out the picture. Don't even go over there. It's nothing in the center of the store that my son can eat. It has one of the allergens in it. It's not useful to me. So I had to really kind of shop the perimeter of the grocery store. And I would look at the produce, the fruit, the vegetables, the meat section, the dairy in the back. And I would kind of look at it and say, this isn't quite right either. There's only one kind of apple. There's only one kind of orange. And I began to really understand that there was something more important to the food than just getting it. Because now I'm looking for the nutritional value of the food. It's important to me as a mom to make sure that not only was the food absent of the allergens, but the food was nutritionally sound for my son because he's a baby, and so now I'm making baby food. And I needed to know that it was free of pesticides. I didn't want that in my son's food. I didn't want food that was genetically modified. I had been hearing about genetically modified food. I didn't want food that was grown in sewer sludge. I didn't want that either. Yet when I looked at this food, it wasn't labeled. It said it might have said at this time, this was about 10 years ago, you know, this orange came from Florida. Well, what part of Florida? And who grew it in Florida? And under what conditions? was this orange produced? How long had it been on the shelves? How long had it been in the hands of the business that was selling it? No one really knew the answers to those questions. And sometimes I would mess with store managers and just ask them stuff like that. Just to be a pest. Like, well, where did this come from? And they're like, Florida? I'm like, that's a good guess. But you're selling it, don't you know? Well, I guess I could maybe find out. Bingo. You know, I'll wait. They'd be like, well, why don't you like come back like next week? You know, I need time to research it. And that's important, I think, because they didn't know either. There's a lot of assumptions along the supply chain. A lot of assumptions that we really need to address. We have to be more concrete. I'm more concrete about, you know, where some of my socks come from than I am about the food that I was eating at that time. But I learned that the food system had changed tremendously. I mentioned to you what I learned as I started to do my little food research. I realized that, you know, this thing called genetically modified organisms was now in our food system, and nobody asked me about it. I didn't get the bulletin that said, this is the thing that we're going to use to expand agriculture in the United States. This is the, you know, this is the cure for hunger. I didn't hear that. I heard that later. I heard that genetically modified food was in our food system about the same time that I heard that 80% of corn and soy was genetically engineered. And I was a little concerned about that. And I got really concerned when I was looking at the cover of the New York Times, and they had this color picture of Greenpeace dumping 10 tons of genetically modified grain on Tony Blair's driveway. And the first thought to me, you know, in my mind was like, how is he going to clean that up? And I'm like, God, they're really upset about this genetically modified food thing, you know, to just dump 10 tons of it, to go get 10 tons and just drive it into the middle of London. I was recently in London, so I got it to go where's, I think it's 10 something. Yeah, that one, 10 Downing Street. So I got to go past there, and I'm like, it was funny to me, because then I could imagine this huge truck kind of just backing up and just playing, shoo, and then Greenpeace just kind of speeding off and, you know. Oh, the people in London are so funny. But my question was like, well, why are they so upset about it? And why aren't we? There was no public outcry. There were a few organizations at that time that were organizing. I remember the Organic Consumers Association, Ronnie Cummings really being very outspoken against genetically modified organisms. But there's no national, you know, named activist organization that was, you know, dumping grain in front of the White House, which could have been interesting, I think, during that time. You know, another event that caught my attention, and it caught my attention because by way of just sort of introduction, I'm a community organizer. I've been working in community organizing many years, and one of the events that caught my attention, of course, are events where activists are out, you know, pushing the envelope just a little bit. And then one of these events where activists were out pushing the envelope just a tiny bit was the battle in Seattle. Yeah, it was an awesome event. I have to tell you that I didn't get my invitation to come to the battle in Seattle. I was at home, and I turned on the news and was having a conversation with another friend of mine who's also an activist. She works internationally in reproductive health. And just sort of looked at the news just briefly, and I remember having a reaction saying, you know, well, where are they? because the word police was written in English across the chest of the law enforcement officers, and they had on the bulletproof vests and rifles and gearing up with riot gear. And they were facing down what looked like to be a bunch of kids. And she asked me, she was like, well, what's going on? And I'm like, I don't know. And she was like, well, didn't anybody tell you about this? Or do you know? And I'm like, I don't know anything about it. None of my network knew anything about the battle in Seattle, but it was going on, definitely. And they were getting it on in Seattle. And they were getting it on in the United States. And they were protesting something called the World Trade Organization. And I'm like, what's that? And why are they so excited about it? And why didn't I know anything about this? How do I kind of get up with what's going on with them? I call these events to your attention because I know that many of you are probably activists or organizers, and it's really useful, I think, to understand from a community standpoint, someone who does not have the information that you have, someone who simply does not have the access that you have, can now look at something, be puzzled by it, but not quite understand what's going on, and not necessarily be motivated to move. Those become the teachable moments by which we can engage community, if we can just get them to see it for a split second. And it was that split second. There was, as you probably know, no national coverage on the battle in Seattle. There was just, you know, kids are rioting, they're tearing up the McDonald's, oh my God, somebody stop them. That was it, pretty much. But it caused me to really want to look deeper into what this activist movement was about. So as I started to really do that, I had to come to the realization that, you know, number one, at the end of the day, I got to have food on the table. I've got to get to what it is I want. I've already, figured out that I don't want food that's genetically modified. I don't want food that's grown with lots and lots of pesticides. I don't want food that's grown in, you know, fertilizers and stuff like that. I want food that's fresh. I want it free from all those contaminants and any other ones that I don't know anything about. I just want healthy, fresh food for my son. I like to get this as close to my house as I can, which becomes another interesting opportunity to have a dialogue. But that's all I wanted. And I was told that pretty much I was saying that I wanted organic food. Well, whatever you want to call it, that's what I wanted, and that is how I began to build the diet of my son and my daughter on organic food. And going out to get the organic food, I had accepted that a part of that journey was just to go all over the place and get it. I would go to this farmer's market. I would go to this store over here. There's, you know, this guy over here who's in the back room of the health food store on the left side who's selling this. And then I go to the next store, and the woman in the front is selling that. And all day I could spend procuring food, not for the month, for the week, or for maybe even the few days. One day I called my sister, and my brother-in-law, Bill, answered the phone. And he said, my sister wasn't home. She went to the grocery store, and she would be back in 5 minutes. And I'm like, what do you mean 5 minutes? It'd take me all day to go grocery shopping. Nobody gonna be back in 5 minutes. But I thought about that. She lives about 5 minutes from about two grocery stores. And I'm on the other side of town. 5 minutes from my house, I can't grocery shop. Now, what I can get 5 minutes from my house is not necessarily useful, but I can get it. And I've said this, you know, everywhere I go. But 5 minutes from my house, I could get access to, you know, a great variety of potato chips. I mean, the plethora, the depth and the breadth of potato chips I can get on the west side of Chicago. I didn't know that there were so many different kinds of cigarettes. I could get all kinds of flavored cigars and things. I could get alcohol. I can get all great varieties of malt liquor. If I wanted to get a gun, I could get one. If I wanted to buy cocaine or marijuana, I could get that. It would take less than 5 minutes to get that, actually. I could just go like, hey. But an organic tomato, a cup of yogurt, granola, was not accessible 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes from my house. And that began a very interesting conflict in me, because I was a person who had resources in my neighborhood. I lived in a mixed income community, so I had a car, and you know, I knew where stuff was. I'm, you know, relatively well educated, at least so I thought, until I got introduced to the food system. I felt kind of stupid after that. But I know how to put something together, and I know how to get it, and usually I have the resources to go after it. But what if the person next door to me has children that have the food issues that my son has, and they don't have a car, and they don't have the health insurance that allows me to get the health diagnosis that I got from my son, which is that he had severe food allergies, he had asthma. What if she can't or he can't get that food? What does that family do? And that question stayed in my mind, because I really needed to understand what would a solution look like, not just for my family. I figured it out for my family by the food. But what does a community-centered solution look like? And at that time, I was introduced to a phrase that I'm going to share with you. And the phrase is, every community has the intellect to heal itself. It's the motto of my organization, the Institute for Community Resource Development. And I borrowed that phrase from an architect, the chief architect of the park system in Chicago, which was designed during one of the great expositions in Chicago. And he was this world-renowned architect, Jans Jensen. And his whole philosophy around parks and park systems was that they were the intricate, the heart of the community, the soul of a community. And he built the parks like they were that. They are the main arteries still today in Chicago, where you can drive through a community and get a sense and get introduced to the community through its green space, its open space. And that's been pretty much preserved all along the lakefront and the west and south sides of the city. But as he neared retirement in his career, he decided that he was going to move to Tennessee. And people were telling him, oh my God, aren't the people of the community you're moving to, aren't they going to be, they're so lucky and fortunate to have you. You're going to come down there and, you know, you're going to go and you're just going to make everything perfect for them. And he said, well, it's probably already pretty perfect. He's like, I only have a skill set, and I apply it as the community encourages me to, but I'm not an expert in that community. He's like, in fact, I don't know anything about the community. I have not really met anybody, but every community has the intellect to heal itself, and if they want something that I have, they have the intellect to draw it from me, and I have the skill set to apply what they want. And I've adopted that as a part of not just my organization's view, but whenever I go and talk to communities around the country or around the world, I really reinforce to them, no matter what your profession is, you can be an urban planner. I just came back from Europe and spoke to lots of urban planners, but they have a skill set. Without the soul invested in that skill set, it really isn't something that can be offered as a viable solution. And so their skill set has to be offered to community in a way that supports the traditional knowledge of that community. Because the knowledge to heal the community is there. It doesn't lie with me. I told someone earlier today, if what I've done is instructive and informative to you, of course, please, by all means, use it, but don't make me the blueprint. You'll be messed up. There's a lot of smudges on it, a lot of learning. Make your community your place of learning. Make your community the place of high intellect. Make your traditional knowledge the community scholarly knowledge that really needs to be applied to change the community. And I think if we apply that to our food system, that we will end up with the food system that we've looked for all along. So what are the solutions? Well, of course, using food as a tool to organize. Food is one of the things that I had never anticipated organizing around. But it's one of those things that I found that once you bring people around the table, it's impossible for anyone at that table to say that the next person doesn't have the right to eat. I've never had anyone say, you know, LaDonna, I hear what you're saying, I hear you, I feel you, but your son just does not get, you know, the right to have organic food. I mean, he just eat whatever's available. I've never had that happen. And I've sat around the table with a lot of people who, you know, you may not, you know, consider, like, you know, why would you be talking to people from, you know, ADM or something like that? There is no disagreement that everybody eats. And so from that small place where there's agreement, what we have to find is the next place of agreement, and then the next place. And that's how the food can be used as a tool to not just organize our communities in terms of who we live next door to, but our broader, larger community. It takes a step at a time. But the solutions, you know, I just decided, like, you know what? This riding all over the city is ridiculous. I'm looking at this lettuce at Whole Foods. Do you all have a Whole Foods up here? Oh, you're so lucky. We have several Whole Foods in Chicago. But I was at this one particular one that I had come accustomed to going to, and they had beautiful lettuce on sale, and it was, I think it was $8 a pound. Right. And by chance, I had walked past the lettuce seeds, and they were 99 cents for like a, it was like a no-brainer, right? It was 99 cents for a packet of seeds. And these were organic seeds with a beautiful, you know, drawing on it. And I'm looking at the seed, and I'm looking at this lettuce, and I'm like, how much does it really take to turn these seeds into that? How much does it really take? And I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to find out, because this $8 is not, it's not working for me. So I went home, and my husband and I converted our backyard to our little kind of mini farm experiment. And I just put the seeds out there. And I did a lot more reading, a lot more talking, a lot more research, and I ran into a gentleman who was the head of Seeds for Change, and he said something that made so much sense, because, you know, I was just like, well, you know, we're in Chicago, how do we, you know, grow this different stuff, and, you know, it's not really the right kind of climate, this, that, and the other. And he said, well, seeds don't know where they are. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? they only respond to conditions. The right conditions will get you the right growth. You'll get the product that you want. And I'm like, God, that was simple. Seeds only respond to conditions. So I put the seeds out there in the compost and put some water on it and like, okay, we'll see what happens. Germination rate, okay, a couple days here, sprouting. Like, wow, this is a little easier. About a week or two, little baby lettuce came up. You know, a couple days after that, it's time to get the scissors. I'm like, this might work out. I got a chance, though, to be introduced to the process of putting my hands in the soil, getting the food out of the soil, being nourished by what comes out of the soil, but leaving that soil in better condition than it was when I started. And we forget that the key to agriculture, the purpose of agriculture, is the preservation of culture. We get really caught up in the byproduct. We want those beautiful heirloom tomatoes. We want that lettuce. But really what we're after, and what we've all been talking about all day, and what all of the plenary talks have been about, is building community. But without healthy soil, it's not possible to have a healthy community. And so our agriculture, even our small organic efforts at agriculture, have to be about revitalizing soil as the foundation to building community. It can't happen any other way. So I began this whole idea about, if I could do it in my backyard, where else can we do it? My husband decided one day he wanted to become a farmer. Again, a whole nother topic. We don't want to go there. But I was like, you know, honey, getting into farming is cost prohibitive. It's $28,000 an acre at that time for land, farmland, in the state of Illinois. I'm like, there's no way to get into farming. And until I looked out my backyard across from the, we have alleys in Chicago, and there's a vacant lot over there. And there was another vacant lot across the street in the front of my house that I could see. And I'm like, well, what if we experimented with your desire to be a farmer, and we got some vacant lots, and we farmed on those for our purposes and for community purposes. And he thought I was really crazy at that time, but I couldn't have been any more crazy than he was because he's the one that wanted to farm. But I was just trying to save money. And we set about this trajectory of converting vacant lots to urban farm sites. And the story behind how I even know how to do that really comes from an earlier community action that I worked on at a group called the Northwest Austin Council. As a community organizer, you know, we really sat down and just kind of picked up people's issues. They would come to our office. They would say they had an issue, a situation. I was a general organizer. I didn't have a specific focus, except I was really good at door knocking and going and talking to people. So they would send me out to just kind of do the initial survey of any new area that we were going to. But we had education organizers, and we had folks who specialized in streets and sanitation kind of services, city services. They understood the infrastructure. So we were all pretty young. And we're just sitting around in a, you know, a basement that's probably as big as this podium and, you know, doing our little work and talking about what the issues were of the day. And a woman came in who actually is a sister of my mentor, and her name is Mary Perry, and she said that she had an issue. And we would round robin pretty much. Whoever came in was who you got, you know, if it was your turn. So it was my turn. I got her, and, you know, we sat down and talked about what her issue was. And she said, you know, There's this abandoned building on the corner of my block that is really bothering me because it's across the alley from a school, and kids are walking past this place, and I'm really concerned about it. I want to get it torn down or something. We got to do something with it. It could really be, it's an eyesore. I just don't like it. I'm like, okay. Well, what do we do? I don't know if any of you have heard of Sal Alinsky, but we use the Sal Alinsky organizing model where you sort of identify your targets and pretty much set them up for slaughter. You invite them out to community and, you know, people beat them up pretty good. And then they go back to their office and figure out how to give them whatever it is they want. And that's what we did. So we invited out the City of Chicago Planning Department, building, the aldermen, all these different people. We have this meeting, and we meet, and we talk about it, and basically we decide to go after the landlord. And there was a lot of issues around who owned the building because the building was abandoned. The city had placed a lien on it because the owner didn't pay taxes, but the bank hadn't taken possession of the building. It was in foreclosure, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't quite theirs at this point. The landlord was definitely, or the owner of the building was definitely responsible for the building, but he didn't want to do anything about it. So one Saturday morning, we got like a school busload of community residents who lived around that building, and we went out to his house about 8 o'clock in the morning, and they had like picket signs and bullhorns, and they were saying that he was a slum landlord. And the next day, that building was boarded up. And we were like, yay, victory. Pizza, beer for everybody. Then the next week, Mary was back. And she said, you know, I got an issue. Well, she's my person, so I've got to work with her. So, okay, what's your issue? I've been looking at this building all weekend. It's boarded up. It's ugly as all get out. I don't think I like the ugly building on my corner. It's messing up my property values. Can we do something else with the building? I'm like, well, what do we do? It's not like we're going to pick it up and move it. And she was like, well, can we tear it down or something? I'm like, I don't know. If that's what you want to do, then my job is to figure out how to get that done or present to you, you know, whatever the viable solutions are. So we had one of those crazy meetings again with the city, got them all out. The landlord was more than willing to come out this time, the owner of the building, rather. And we started to brainstorm around, well, whose responsibility is this building? And the organization that I worked with had really began the groundbreaking work around a thing called nuisance abatement, which a community group could come in the state of Illinois, take over a building that was a nuisance in the community. Make a long story short, we were able to do that, take the building, have the building torn down, have the debris removed, and now it's a vacant lot. Victory, yay, more pizza and beer. A couple days later, guess who shows up? She's like, you know, I'm looking at that vacant lot. It's not working for me either. I just don't think that we should have vacant lots in my community. I'm like, well, you the reason why it's vacant. She's like, yeah, but, you know, I'm just saying, you know, we need to find something else to do with this lot. And I'm like, well, what do you want to do with it? Well, I think we should put flowers on it. I'm like, well, whose responsibility is that? She was like, I'm like, not me. I'm like, well, we have to make that definitely a community effort. But who owns the land in the community? Now, obviously, we put in a lot of labor and a lot of time on this particular building, but my organization does not own the land that the building sat on. The land is owned by the City of Chicago, which would mean, of course, that it should be owned by the taxpayers of the City of Chicago, but our mayor doesn't always see things that way. So we started to kind of investigate, well, how can you go about planting on an urban, in an urban setting? What will it take to really get this flower garden put into the community? And whose responsibility will it become once it's there? Who owns it, who takes care of it. We pushed very hard on that, and that process took longer than the other processes of getting the building boarded up, getting the building torn down. But getting the city to understand that this land, while it was supposedly owned by the city of Chicago, it was directly related to community, and so they had a responsibility to figure out with us what to do with it, not for us. So what we ended up doing was planting a beautiful garden. The city allowed us to put the land in a trust, which later became a group called NeighborSpace, which is the city's trust. It's a public-private partnership where any community group now can go to the city of Chicago, identify a vacant lot. The organization will go to court, buy that lot for $1, and then that lot goes into a trust. The lot cannot be pulled out of the trust. It's never happened yet, let's put it that way. And so a developer can't come in after you have your land put into this trust and say, I want to build condos here now. But Mary Perry is the woman who introduced me to this idea, and she has since gone on to, at 60, she was 63, I think, at the time we were doing all this work, she's gone on to convert about 25 or 30 vacant lots to flower gardens, and she's the president of what's called the Austin Green Team now. But that was my introduction to the community's capacity to heal itself. She had all that with her. I had the tool set to pull it out of her. But what she left me with was the passion to change community to what was an eyesore in some people's minds, but was really a resource in her mind, and how could we bring her vision forward. And so that's the beginning of the Urban Agriculture Project. We converted 10 vacant lots to urban farm sites. We hired people from the community. We grew food that later went to a farmer's market. We started a farmer's market working with a group of African-American farmers who were about 50 miles outside of the city. They were growing food organically. They wanted a place to sell their food. We wanted food to buy. They came to the market. We got people to the market. They bought the food. It sounds simple. It wasn't. It was painful. It hurt a lot. It was many long, cold days on a Saturday morning waiting for trucks to come. We worked with a group called Angelic Organics. Angelic Organics has a community-supported agriculture project, one of the largest in the country. Thousands of people are members of their project, and they brung their boxes, and we had a drop-off site on the west side of Chicago. Our goal to bring food into the community was being realized. There's another process kind of going on at the same time. There was this entire process of what do we do in a community that doesn't have access to this healthy food that we want? What do we do to build our own grocery store? Well, you know, I don't know how I ended up with this job, actually, because I don't remember saying that I wanted to build the grocery store. But through a series of community meetings, where I'm sure Mary Perry was at, we had this conversation about what was going on in our neighborhood that we didn't have a grocery store. And if we wanted a grocery store, why couldn't we just build it ourselves? So when I say me and I go around and I talk about this work, it's not really me. It's really a big we. There were hundreds of people who invested a lot of time and energy in a lot of the projects that, you know, I get to sort of stand out in front of. But it's not really, you look at me, you have to look at a we. I really do stand strong because of those people who are standing strong on their ancestors. I'm standing on mine. But it's not me alone. It won't be any of you alone. One person can't do all of this work. One group can't do all of this work. It has to be all of us. And so we decided that we wanted this grocery store, and you know, that's such a long conversation because there were so many interesting nuances to wanting a grocery store, to wanting to do urban agriculture, to wanting a farmer's market. There's all kinds of public policy implications, all kinds of interesting rules and regulations that say you can have hens in the city but not roosters. And I'm like, okay. All kinds of regulations that say artisan food that's produced by someone's hands cannot be sold in the farmer's market. Why? Well, you know, there's this public health thing, you know, germs. Like, yeah. Is that like the salmonella that was in the salad bags? of the food system that's designed to protect our public health interests? I mean, it's not at the hands of artisans that we've had all these public health scares in our food systems. It's been at the hands of the industrial corporate food structure that has produced these public health dramas. There's all kinds of financial reasons, if you will. No public money to actually do a farmer's market. The city of Chicago had well over 75 farmer's markets, and they put them on every year for 15 weeks with less than $10,000. Now, I don't know how they did that. But the assumption was that just put it there and people will come. We wanted marketing, you know, for our market. Wanted people to know that they were there. We wanted farmers to be able to, you know, at least get their gas money if not sell all of their food. But we didn't want anyone to be out of pocket because they were bringing food to our community. So there were lots of public policy kinds of issues. We want to build a local food system, but there's no public policy infrastructure to do so. The public policy infrastructure in the state of Illinois only supports the development of corn and soybeans. And that's it. And maybe the largest vegetable crop produced in Illinois outside of, you know, corn and soybeans is pumpkins. So if you want pumpkins, come to Illinois. But there's no infrastructure to support the development of vegetable and fruit farms in the state of Illinois that bring its food to the city of Chicago for redistribution throughout communities in the city of Chicago. There is no structure for that. There is no public policy structure. There is no money to do it. There sometimes isn't any political will. But that's what the community intellect is about. That's what the organizing is about. It's about creating that political will. It's about nurturing it. It's about those seeds that I found in the grocery store that were 99 cents versus the $8 a pound, you know, fully cut and beautifully, you know, groomed lettuce in the bags. Grooming political will takes time. It takes effort. It takes conversations. Because there is no such thing as a utopian food system. There has never been a perfect food system in the United States of America. And why do I say that? I say that because there's never been a food system based on a land ethic that supported community in the United States of America that was healthy, just, and whole for everyone at the same time. I think about that because I think about that through my own cultural lens. Africans being captured and brought to the New World to build what now is the industrial food system. After the annihilation of Native American cultures and the destruction of the wilderness on the land, a few people got a chance to come and figure out how to grow food for them. So it's on the backs of the Africans and Native Americans and many other immigrant groups that came to build the infrastructure of the United States that our food system exists. And it's time that we acknowledge that. Without that acknowledgement, we can't go forward. We can't get to the intellectual part of the conversation because now we're still all caught up, emotional. One thing that bothered me about the battle in Seattle was that I didn't see any black people. I'm like, so what? I have no role in this? When I started to organize and talk about food justice nationally, generally, I was the only African-American person in the room. I'll even say I was the only person of color in the room most of the time. And this was in 2001 and 2 and 3. But in order for me to have this great concern, not just about the soil in my community, but about your soil in your community, about your trees, about this entire state and its cultural connection to the land, I have to have developed a cultural connection to the land that I'm in. And so you all have to help others facilitate a cultural connection to the land, the traditional knowledge of the land. Without it, you can't have a food ethic. I can't possibly be concerned about that wonderful, beautiful, over 100-year-old seed without understanding my cultural connection to 100 or 200 years ago to those people. I don't have the answer to what the beautiful new food system would look like, but I'm going to share a few of the values that I think a food system has to have in order for it to go forward, in order for us to go forward, in order for us to be here. I keep thinking about the woman who spoke earlier. I think her first name was Lily. She said that, you know, she was called and, you know, the calling was talking to her and the calling was telling her, you know, if you don't do it, you gonna die. And the rest of y'all ain't gonna be worth a plug nickel. And she was like, yeah, but I'm scared. I understood that. Because if I didn't do it, I know that my son would have died. I know, and that would have killed me. And then the people that come behind me wouldn't have a chance. So I have to take that courage and put it into something that makes a little bit more sense. And so I put it into really trying to understand that we have to have a soul, we have to have a system that has a soul. And our food system can use the acronym, turn the word soul into an acronym and make it sustainable, organic, urban, and local. And embrace all of the possibilities. See, this is not an either-or proposition. It is a both-and. One cannot be better than the other one. It's a network of ideas and a network of people doing what may seem like different things, but really working toward the common goal, building a vibrant community. To build the soul food system, I'm going to share with you like 9 principles. Now, I'm a little weird in this way. This is not like we haven't done any scientific research on this. I did not do a community study on this, but this is just some of the things that I've come to believe will actually help us get to where we want to go when we start to talk about soul food systems and viable food systems. And one is to start small. Someone here, I think her name is Kim, wants to do a store. And she was like, I got that. What do I do? I got this idea. I got these people. I got this, like, you know, 75% done business plan. And I was like, start small. Start where you are. but start. You can't just say, oh, you know, the conditions are not perfect. The wind is not going the right way today. I can't start. You have to start where you are. There's a phrase by Booker T. Washington that we joke about in my personal family, and it says, cast your bucket down where you are. That's all you have. If it's just one or two of you, that's enough. Maybe three. If the three of you are thinking along the same lines, you've got a good bet going. There's probably a fourth somewhere else. But don't exclude anybody. That's the second principle. Everybody is welcome. Pull up a chair, have a seat, let's talk about it. Because we need the other in this work. It's not, you can't have a vibrant food system with a monoculture. I mean, have we been screaming this to the world? It has to be multicultural. And whether that culture is visible because of different skin tones and complexions, you know, that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about getting all the colors right in the crayon box. I'm talking about differences, being able to manage differences around the table. We have to build with the next generation in mind. I know that there's a Native American saying that talks about thinking about decisions today in terms of 10 generations from now. That, I love that saying. But we get so caught up in the 10 generations. Oh my God, that's so much. Okay, just think about your kid. Let's think about what it would take to get your child, when they're an adult, into the grocery store that you want to build, or get them working the land that you're working. What will it take? I'm going to suggest to you off the top that you're not going to come up with the easy solution, but that will give you plenty of things to think about and talk about in your little group of three. What will it take? The third principle is leave your weapons. There's no reason to fight. I saw a beautiful poem being done today during the plenary talks about the war in Afghanistan. And I have to say, while it was a really heart-wrenching performance, and this is not critical of the woman who wrote it, it's beautiful. I think sometimes we have to take our magic magnifying glass and turn it around on us. Are we fighting in our groups? Have we taken out our Scud missiles in our communities and gunned people up because they don't agree with us? Or they're not moving the way that we think they ought to move? Or they don't have the same political background or the same education? Or don't come from where you come from. Leave your weapons. This is not work that you can do because you hate somebody. This is work you can do because you love someone. And you love them deeply enough to love them in spite of their differences, in spite of your differences. But the love is what's going to remain. See, love doesn't run out. It doesn't burn you up. It doesn't kill you. Hate and anger will. Leave your weapons. Focus on the content. That's the fourth principle. Focus on building the content. Kim asked a beautiful question. What does the product mix look like? Well, the product mix looks like whatever the people, your little three group, whatever you all think it should be, yeah, that's the product mix. Build the content. People tend to talk about what they know. So if they don't know what the product mix is, they might start talking about anything. I don't know, Copper River salmon or something. Well, that should be part of the product mix, but at this point, You might not have the capacity to have Copper River salmon in your store. You might only have the capacity to have a few soaps and lotions because you got a small space. Maybe a few things that have been canned. Maybe you can only do your thing on the weekends, every week, for 20 weeks, or 10 weeks, or 5. Maybe it's a festival that you do once a year. I don't know what it is, but focus on the content of your gathering. Tell your stories. The only thing that I can tell you about telling stories is that that's what people remember. I've been doing this public speaking since I was a kid, but I've been talking about this work for the past 10 years. And I didn't tell you, that we have a full research project, that I work with 5 universities. I'll tell you that tomorrow morning. But that I work with 5 universities, and that we've done food assessment studies, and we've done GIS maps, and, we know that $130 million is spent in the Austin community, where there's 171,000 people, and 80% of that $130 million leaves the community. I could give you all kinds of statistics about that. But I guarantee you, tomorrow morning, if I asked you what I said, you would be like, it was a lot of money, and a lot of it left the community. Unless you wrote it down specifically as what I said. But I guarantee you what you would remember is that I went to this talk, and this woman told me about her son having food allergies, and he was allergic to dairy products, shellfish, eggs, blah, blah, blah. I don't remember her name, but she's from Chicago. And then somebody told me, if you're from Chicago, you might know her too. Yeah. That happened to me at a banquet one time. I thought that was so funny. And I wasn't going to say, well, that's me. I mean, it sounds goofy. That's me. Well, my friend was like, that's her. I mean, you talking to the, that's her, And the lady was like, oh, my God. But the point is that she could tell the story, and she became the expert. I'm not an expert. I can only tell you a story. I've got 100 of them. Tell your stories. You might have a tool, you might have a skill set. Granted, we're not going to take that away from you. But it's much better to know that an urban planner wants a community to be healthy and vibrant because they watched their mother die from breast cancer. See, that's a different kind of urban planner than one that's just sort of sitting back and saying, let me see what I can do for you. That one is saying, what can I do for us? How can I submit? How can I commit to this process that does not have that happen to someone else's mother? Tell your stories. Now, this one may be hard for you experts, but no PowerPoints are allowed. Need I say more? 7th principle is control yourself. Bring your energy. Hold on to your passion. Sometimes we can get really polarized because we're so passionate about I'm just going to make something up. We're passionate about the moose being able to graze throughout the city, and we just think that that's the thing that has to do. We got to do it that way, and if we don't do it that way, it's just the world is not right. And we will run everybody out of the room, beating them over the head with that idea. The energy to get something done is valuable. The passion that leads you to beat somebody up about getting it done is not useful. Control yourself. Be curious. It's the 8th principle. I suggest curiosity because of the voice that we just heard. Children are curious. They want to see, they want to look, they want to taste, they want to explore. And sometimes we stifle that down a little bit. We, you know, just don't do that, honey, not right now. Right, exactly. Arr. But in your conversations, in your group of three, your group of four or five, be curious about the other. Not from an interview standpoint. Nobody wants to, you know, be on the 10 o'clock news. But from the standpoint of connection. What is your life like? I was riding with Mark back to the auditorium this evening, and he was, I don't know if he knew these people already. Mark is so chatty. He was chatting with the people at the front desk at the hotel when I got downstairs, and he was telling me about a woman that lives 300 miles away from here. No, this is a village that has 300 people in it, and you can only access this village through by water or by boat. I mean, by water or by plane. And I was like, did he already know her? How did they get to having this particular conversation? But he knew her by name. He talked with her. He was telling me about her. I became curious about their community because Mark's excitement about the information was intoxicating to me. See, I can tell the story of the woman. Now, I don't remember her name, but I know she at the front desk at my where I stay. And I know a little bit about her community. So I'll be interested to hear about other communities that are like that so I can put together a picture. What must it be like to live in a place that's that remote? That's not been my experience. I've been pretty much living in an urban community and then, you know, lately in a more rural community, but certainly, you know, highway bound. I mean, 80 miles an hour, I'd be in Chicago in about 10 minutes, 70 miles away. No problem. But what must it be like to have to rely on that region, you know, for your food? You know, what is it like to not be able to get home when you want to get home? Be curious. The last principle, of course, is be involved. That's an, you know, that's an easy one. I mean, most of us, most of you all are here because you are involved in some way in developing a healthy community. But be involved. And you can be involved in the work that I do in the city of Chicago just by talking about it, by telling the story, by telling someone else the story, or by telling it to yourself again and sending that energy out. Of course, you can be involved here in more tangible ways. I'm sure that, you know, Ellen and some of the organizers here have organizations that they can point you to and lead you to, but be involved. And I share those principles in closing because a deep connection to the land only comes from a deep connection to a place. Without connection through place, without being anchored in a place, I can't care about the land. Without understanding a food, my food, I can't, without understanding the land, I can't understand my food, I can't understand my connection to it, I can't understand what I need to do next. Which is why we have to get this message to the next generation. And we have to stop talking to them like they're baby boomers, too. We've got to talk to them like the new generation that they are. These kids came cable ready. It takes me forever to figure out how to turn on the DVD player. My son can walk right up to it and be like, click. I can't turn on the television or work my iPod without my son and my daughter showing up, Mom, you use your thumb. You swirl it around like this. I'm like, who uses the word swirl? I mean, what are you talking about? But he came to this world ready, technologically ready, physically ready to take us into the next millennium. Without him, I don't think that I would be here. And I have to tell you that I started off this whole conversation talking about him because I really believed as a mother that I was protecting his potential, that it was my job to protect my son's potential. I was to make sure he got in the right schools and do all the right things, and I was supposed to protect him, unbeknownst to me. He came here to protect my potential. He brung me the gift of the love of land, the love of earth, the love of community. He brought me the opportunity for him to show me that it's really the young people who are protecting our potential, not the other way around. It's my hope that we build a community with soul in mind, and that we build community with the future in mind. Thank you. If there's time, I'll take questions.
We do have some time for a couple of questions, and I think we were going to have some mics set up on either side of the room. And oh, great, lights are good too. if there's anyone who did want to ask a question or had a discussion, they can head over to the microphones or just raise your hand and shout out. Okay. Well, thank you again, everyone, for coming, and we're delighted to have your participation this evening. Hope that you'll come and see us tomorrow as well. And thank you, LaDonna, for your time and perspectives. It was great to hear from you.
Thank you. Yeah.